podcast has been organized by the Low Residency MFA in Creative Writing Program at Dominican University of California, under the direction of Dr. Judy Halebski, in collaboration with the Communication and Media Studies Department and Penguin Radio.
Which I didn't get diagnosed with until that point, not through want of trying, I should say. So it was very obvious when I did get the first of the diagnoses that, there's the whole of my life re-explained for me. And I thought, what can I do about this? What I realized very quickly was that my experience of taking a long time to get diagnosed was a very common experience, both with these particular two conditions, which I'll talk about in more depth, and generally with any chronic illness. And when you add other marginalized identities in, obviously that starts to exponentially grow and grow the length of time it can take to get you to diagnosis, and the amount of difficulties you have to wade through in order to reach that point. So I thought, what can I do about it? I'm exhausted. My conditions are energy limiting. I have a lot of chronic pain. I can't really do a lot of active campaigning, but I'm a writer, so I'll write about it. So central to this book is a chapter about diagnosis and about my experience of diagnosis, some of my kind of philosophical thoughts, I suppose, about diagnosis, and some of my experiences. So I'm going to read you a really kind of shortened version of that, because it's a long chapter, I can tell you. It goes on a long way. And in the longer version of the chapter, there are lots of case studies within it of moments in my life where I could have been diagnosed and wasn't, from the age of kind of 18 months onwards. And then eventually we get me to 34, 35, where I do reach the beginning of my diagnoses, I should say, because diagnoses do like to kind of flock together. Once one of them is uncovered, it turns out you've got kind of 18 living in the eaves. So this is diagnosis. Diagnosis is like a wedding, not an end point, but a beginning. Diagnosis is a door opening on the rest of your life. And if the diagnosis is correct, when the door opens, behind it, there will be the tools you need to make life manageable, or the chart that tells you where to go next to find what you need, or a whole new world to walk into. When I was 34, I was given a diagnosis that changed my entire life before it and after it. It made everything after it possible. It made everything before it comprehensible in a way that had never seemed possible. I could understand my own life, my own body, my own story. To diagnose is to distinguish one thing from another, to discern, to know thoroughly. My late sociology supervisor used to delight in repeating the adage, shit data in, shit data out. He was not a distinguished professor for nothing. He knew what mattered. He knew how to distinguish. He was referring to interviewing research subjects, but the same applies to any field of inquiry. You have to ask the right question to get the right answer. You can only diagnose a condition if you are aware it exists in the first place, and if you have an idea of what its presentation might be. You have to believe there is a right question to ask. You have to believe there is an answer. On October 14th, 2014, I took a train down to London from my home in Cumbria. I was excited and terrified. I was going to meet the man who might be able to explain me to myself. But I knew better than that, didn't I? I knew not to be too hopeful. I was less than a month into my first full-time academic job, something I should have been delighted about after years of multiple part-time jobs, taking days of housekeeping in the village to fill the gaps, applying for every job that came up. But I'd forgotten how exhausting it was to start a new job, to wander around a new campus in continual confusion, drained by bafflement. It was like being in a continual anxiety dream where everyone was following a rule you didn't know, but was cross with you for not following. I hadn't been so unhappy in a job since I did Saturday shop work with a bad manager when I was the same age as my students. At the time I'd had my job interview that summer, I'd been discharged by all the clinics I'd been sent to in search of diagnosis. I've been told categorically there is nothing wrong with you. I'd made a complaint by letter, and one of the consultants I'd complained about wrote back that I seemed to want to have cancer, and he couldn't make me have cancer if I didn't. How to respond to someone who so vastly misunderstood my intentions? Of course I didn't want to have cancer. I just wanted him to help me find out what was causing my pain. I knew they weren't right, but what could I do in the face of so much qualified opposition? I tried to believe their diagnosis, nothing, and carry on. I wanted my life to move forward. The job was offered to me and I took it. There was nothing wrong. I could carry on. But on October 15th, 2014, I went into a large, airy consulting room where an elderly man greeted me kindly, shaking my hand gently between both of his. In the room, he asked for my medical history and my family history. He listened carefully and made careful notes. He watched me, he assessed me, he moved my joints and measured my limbs and the extension of my limbs. He felt my skin and looked at my scars. He lay me down on a bench and took my blood pressure and heart rate lying and standing. I left the room an hour later, diagnosed with hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is characterized by hypermobile joints that shift in and out of place and by velvety, fragile skin. It is the most common yet least understood of the Ehlers-Danlos syndromes, collectively known as EDS. The symptoms of the various kinds of Ehlers-Danlos syndromes are caused by mutations in a gene or genes that make collagen and are hereditary, passed from one family member to another. Presentation varies so much that some family members may be largely unaffected, whilst others may be severely ill. Collagen is often described as the glue that holds the body together. My glue is not sticky, but stretchy. The fault in my collagen means everything in my body is stretchier than it should be. I am poorly strung together. My bones do not stay where they should be because the ligaments and tendons holding them in place are floppy. My stomach overextends every time I eat, and my bowel is too floppy to squeeze food along it properly. Sometimes my throat flops closed. When I stand, the blood sinks down my body, pooling in my overly stretched blood vessels so they can't get it back up again. It gathers in my hands and lower limbs until a gray film appears over my eyes and I feel increasingly sick and unsteady. If I don't sit down or put my feet up, my speech starts to slur, the light dims right down to dried blood brown, and eventually I faint. The time in between, when I can't speak and cry at the light, can last for eons. There are names for all of these things and reasons for them, things that might help them. They are not just how I am. They are not just something I have to live with. That is what diagnosis gave me. All these years, these ridiculous years of not knowing, and it took 1 hour with the right person, someone who could ask the right questions and understand the answers. I left the shiny room and the glass ward reception area and went down in a lift to the entrance hall and found a toilet and locked myself in and cried. Not because I knew now that what I had was genetic, was part of me and would not go away and could not be taken away, but because I finally knew what it was. That was all I had wanted, to know what it was, what I was. There are many barriers to diagnosis. Some of them are cultural and revolve around biases and prejudices about patients and ignorance about certain conditions. Some are more practical and revolve around access to resources and up-to-date information. These practical barriers are also cultural. They reflect a culture that doesn't care enough about diagnosing chronic conditions, that ignores and prejudges whole categories of people, that doesn't prioritize getting the right answers for people, and making sure all people have equal access to healthcare and to the information they need to manage their conditions. The symbol that's been adopted for EDS is a zebra in response to an oft-repeated aphorism coined by 19th century American physician Theodore Woodward. When you hear hoofbeats, expect horses, not zebras. It's become so ubiquitous in medical teaching, few people seem to realize it actually has an author and an origin story. It's treated like a parable. I see the point and why it's become so widespread. It is, of course, statistically more likely that a patient presenting symptoms could suggest a very rare disease has actually got a much more common one, that they are a horse, in effect, not a zebra. Zebras do exist, though. There are certain circumstances under which, in fact, they may be more common. If, for example, you're in a grassland or savanna in southern or eastern Africa, you might be more likely to find a group of equus quagga or plain zebra than a single horse. Equally well, if you're at a zoo. Sometimes hoofbeats will belong to a zebra or a donkey or a mawari or a tapir or an ox or a hippopotamus or a dolphin or a camel or a pig or a llama or a giraffe or a whale, all of which and many more are hooved creatures, ungulates, a much broader category than you might think. There is a cartoon shared in EDS groups in which a zebra is sitting in a doctor's office and the doctor is saying, "You're a perfectly healthy horse except for those stripes. But I wouldn't worry about the stripes too much. We see this sometimes. You just need to diet and exercise. If that doesn't work, try these antidepressants." It's hilarious because it's also horrifying. It's all of our experiences. May 2017. I'm sitting in a very entertaining talk at a book festival by a doctor who has written a best-selling book about the human body. He is funny, erudite, thoughtful. I think for a moment, this is the right kind of doctor. And then the zebra line comes trotting out of his mouth. And my heart, I'm pretty sure, actually falls through my chest, melts a hole in the floor and exits the building. He had been talking about patients who come into his office, have looked things up online and think they have some kind of rare syndrome. Ha, ha, ha. Everyone laughed at the stupid Google patients. I shake through the rest of the talk. In the question and answer session afterwards, I raise my trembling arm and ask him whether he thinks that phrase has any place in medicine today, considering how it becomes a barrier to diagnosis for many people. May happens to be EDS Awareness Month, and I think I can't let this pass, not here, not today, not whilst I have a voice to use. There is an awkward hush in the room as I try to say this. He admits that while zebras are rare, they do exist, but unicorns don't. The kind of people he was referring to are unicorns, really, not zebras at all. The audience laugh, the awkwardness is smoothed over, except for me. He made it funny again, makes my question seem silly. I couldn't stop coming back to this afterwards. Why did it upset me so much? Is it because it perpetuates the notion that horses are normal and natural? Is it because all it does is shift the boundaries of what is implausible, zebra, to what is impossible, unicorn? Is it because he was so sure that he would know how to recognize one from the other? Is it because I had still been willing to believe so readily in the good doctor after all I'd seen? I came away quite sure that for all his cleverness and wit, he would not have managed to help me find the right door. He was too sure he knew an antelope from a pronghorn. Unicorn is dangerously close in my mind to narwhal, another of the ungulates, the hoofed mammals, although it's strange to think of it so. A narwhal tusk was presented to Elizabeth I by Sir Humphrey Gilbert as the horn from a sea unicorn. Changing one unlikely animal for another does nothing to collapse the problem the aphorism poses. It's time doctors were encouraged to distinguish between different kinds of hoofbeats, to look at the evidence in front of them, and to consider all options rather than assume all animals are horses. Just prior to my EDS diagnosis, the pain consultant in my local hospital told me that he never tells patients with what he called hyperflexile joints that joint hypermobility can be a part of a wider condition because they would just worry about it. In one breath, he said I was too young to be on the kind of serious painkillers I was on, but also that there was no point in seeking the source of my pain, searching for a reason. I just had to accept it. Needless to say, he did not help me at all. The problem was I just couldn't accept my pain. The problem was I had to keep asking why. Going into a doctor's office is not a neutral act when you've been seeking diagnosis for a long time. It comes with the old panic, the old anxieties around not being believed, dragging a clanging tin can train of insult and abuse. I had been searching for a diagnosis for years by the time Professor Graham took my hand in his. though how many exactly, it's hard to unpick. I think of the particular quest resulting in my 2014 diagnosis as beginning in 2009 when I developed voice problems, which led to a spiraling collapse over the following years. But seen from another angle, that shift in late 2009 represents nothing more than the resumption of normal service after a short pause. Throughout my life, I have oscillated between actively seeking medical help and pretending to be healthy to try and avoid medical help whilst recovering from the last round of trying to seek it. Even now, armed with knowledge, I lie to myself when I look back at certain times about how well I was coping, how healthy I was. These phases never last long. I managed to keep one going for the most part through my undergraduate degree, only floundering when I broke my left elbow at the end of a 6-month job contract after graduation. For the most part, glosses over the terrible headaches I'd started to have and the strange heart rhythms that sometimes came with them, and made for a fun few hours hooked up to an ECG machine in UCLH when I should have been working in a shop in Covent Garden. It covers the time in first year I slipped in the shower and re-cracked my right elbow. It covers a lot of stomach problems I chose to mostly ignore because I'd found no help with them before and had become afraid to mention them. Pretending to be healthy when you're not is especially exhausting. It takes up energy you could be using to keep yourself as well as you can. If enough people tell you you are creating your symptoms, you have to consider it. Maybe even start to believe it against the silent screams of your body. In Sick, Parashista Kapoor writes about how she came to terms with the idea that it made a kind of sense to her being, as she was, a storyteller, a writer, an inventor. She wrote, "I was, after all, someone who created in the mind." Years pass as you try to convincingly be sick only in the way they want you to be, as so much of your limited energy is lost in ignoring what you know to be real. Diagnosis entered the English language in the way we still use it in the 1680s. Misdiagnosis was added in 1880. Misdiagnosis goes in hand with diagnosis, the flip side of the coin. The difference between the one and the other depends on the kind of data you're working with and your method of interpretation. Misdiagnosis is always hovering under diagnosis, the underneath, the demonic twin. How can you be sure which is standing in front of you, taking you by the hand and asking you to follow it? In 2010, after I lost my voice, I was sent to a therapist to learn how to speak more easily, to take speech easily on the throat. She listened to me croak and told me I had my pitch all wrong. She taught me exercises. She taught me to massage my larynx. She told me to sip water constantly. She taught me to release the muscles in my throat. I take a part-time job in a school, just 2 classes, enough and not too much. In the mornings, I do my exercises in the shower. Monday, I sip water through class. Other things are going wrong in my body, but everyone says they can't find a reason why. Some days my stomach hurts so much I lie on the floor and cry. At a gig I take my partner to for his birthday, I start to feel sick and peculiar until I have to go and sit in the back. Every time the strobe comes on, I burst into tears. No one can tell me why. I begin to blame the city for it, the mold in his flat, the disappointment of turning 30 with no job, no home of my own. I miss the mountains and the lakes. When I'm offered some teaching that autumn at Lancaster University, we move north together. I'm only teaching part-time, hourly paid. Enough, but not too much. The rest of the time I work on finishing my thesis. I struggle to breathe lying down, and it feels like there's a lump in my throat all the time, but they all say it is nothing. I dream I'm dying. I do my voice exercises. Monday, I learn to sip water all the time, not to speak unless I need to. The problem was I had been speaking wrong all these years. I thought I had a voice and could use it, but I had wasted it. The problem was I misspoke, and it all meant nothing much at all. It is November 2012. I am in a bed on a hospital ward somewhere in Lancaster Royal Infirmary. I've been brought up to a ward after taking myself to A&E because the pain in my abdomen that has been dominating my life for a month has become excruciating. I haven't slept. It is this bad because the day before I had an ultrasound to investigate the pain. The ultrasound did not find a reason for the pain, but during the investigation, the wand did press hard for some time on the area where the pain lived, and the pain, like an angry beast, woke up. This is how I come to think of it. A creature that lives in me, sleeps under my ribs, is made angry by contact. I learned to keep everything away from it. Do not disturb. I went to A&E after teaching a class translucent with pain at the university, thinking that since the hospital and the university are in the same town, I might as well do both. I taught my class because I couldn't afford not to, and because I had learned to handle pain. Keep going unless you literally can't. In the hospital, they pressed again on the places where the pain lived, and I was too exhausted by it to cry, but leaked at the eyes. My blood sugar dropped, so they gave me a drip, and after some hours of confusion, admitted me to gynecology, suspecting a problem with an ovary. Women have problems with their ovaries. This is how I came to find myself on a ward bed, waiting to find out if I am to be admitted or sent home. When the young male gynecologist does his ward rounds, he tells me it is hard to work out what might be causing abdominal pain in women because there is just so much in there. I imagine radiologists poring over CT scans of women's abdomens filled with space junk, tin cans, old bicycles, the Loch Ness monster, an actual kitchen sink. He sends me home. 18 months later, I will find out that the pain came from a broken rib, and the broken rib is the key to my diagnosis. Diagnosis is not a single moment. It is ongoing. It is a continual process of learning, of asking questions and analyzing answers. Diagnoses unfold one from another like paper chain people. This is another reason why getting it right is important. A wrong diagnosis breaks the link and suddenly nothing makes sense. A wrong diagnosis drags the whole lot of them down. Say a diagnosis is a door, it leads to a path or a corridor, and you follow it, and that route leads to another door, another diagnosis, and you open it. It's the labyrinth of the body that you are trying to work your way through. Diagnosis is chronic too. The process of diagnosis, of learning, of seeking, never ends. Like all other parts of the chronic life, it moves in cycles, in repetitive arcs. A correct diagnosis allows the arc to expand into a spiral, to keep moving and evolving. A wrong diagnosis keeps you stuck on a locked circuit, going round and round, going nowhere. So a year to the day after my diagnosis with EDS, I found myself sitting in another consulting room in front of a different doctor, a gastroenterologist I had been referred to help manage my EDS symptoms. She'd ordered a lot of routine but very thorough tests. All of the lab tests came back normal, except one. The levels of ferritin in my blood, one measure of how much iron we have in our system, were very high, over 1,000 when the normal range is less than 250. She explained this might mean that I had a second genetic condition, a metabolic disorder called hemochromatosis. She referred me back through my local hospital for gene testing, and in January 2016, it was confirmed. People with genetic hemochromatosis absorb too much iron in their diets. Too much iron is being stored in my body, far too much, deposited in my joints and stashed in skin and my vital organs. Allowed to remain unchecked or grow further, these iron stores will cause serious organ damage. If I hadn't been diagnosed with EDS, I would not have been diagnosed with hemochromatosis. Professor Graham's diagnosis gave me back control over my life. Dr. Zarate Lopez's tests saved my life. One would not have happened without the other opening the right door. Diagnosis is a chain, link to link. It can drag you down or give you a lead to follow. When Dr. Zarate Lopez picked up my high iron levels, she said something I've thought for a long time, that many doctors, when faced with a patient with a clear history of one condition, choose to put every single thing the patient complains of down to that one pre-known condition. and don't do the appropriate investigative work to find out what is really causing the symptoms. I say choose because I think it is a choice. It's a deliberate, if subconscious, looking away. It is easier not to keep on asking questions. It is easier to stop looking for answers. Correct diagnosis saves lives. Correct diagnosis makes lives bearable. It gives you access to the right treatment. It gives the patient agency. It gives the patient the language to describe their realities to others in ways that they will understand. It gives the patient back trust in their own interpretation of their body's weather. It gives the patient back trust that someone in the medical profession has seen them, heard them, acknowledged them, not dismissed them. It gives back hope. What a difference knowing not just about EDS, but about hemochromatosis at 17 could have made in my life. The years of pain and terrifying symptoms I could have avoided. The spells of deterioration, the downward spirals, the periods of unshakable mental gloom, the periods of medical despair, the periods of damaging myself trying to push through because there is nothing wrong. I think about damage that might be irreversible and what it would be like to not have it, to have avoided it. I think about all the pointless invasive tests and wrong medications I have had, the insulting and patronizing consultations, the doctors who have told me I need to stop, how all this could have been avoided if only the right questions had been asked at the right time. If only someone, just one person amongst the dozens I saw, had known to ask the right question, known how to interpret the answer, known how to turn the answers into change. I think not just about the physical damage, but the emotional damage, the years of uncertainty and mistrust that could have been avoided, the trauma that could have been avoided, the panic I contend with every time I go into a doctor's office, the constant fear of dismissal, of not being believed. I wonder who I would be if I weren't continually worried about not being believed. I think of all the moments when a door opened just to crack and then was slammed shut, how much of me was crushed each time. I think about the parts of my life that have been put on hold, deferred because of mismanaged illness, again and again and again, and how none of this needed to have happened if someone, just one person, had only asked the right questions back in 2013, 2009, 2004, 1997, 1995, 1994, 1986, 1984, 1982. So that's my story. Thank you. And then obviously when you become interested in these kind of questions about diagnosis, you start to see them in other places. So my thesis, which I referred to in that piece, was based here in Grasmere, where I still live or again live. And it was about how Grasmere became Grasmere, really, how meaning was created around place through different media, and looking at the lives of William Wordsworth and his sister Dorothy, who lived here at Grasmere and made it famous through their writing. And something kind of funny happened where in 2014, I was sitting in a conference paper at the Wordsworth Summer Conference, and I heard an academic talking about Dorothy's illness later in her life and referring to the last period of her life as 20 years of darkness. And I realized that this was a really common way to look at her later life. And I hadn't really thought about it myself up until then. I knew that she became ill at some point and that she became less active, but I hadn't really looked into it. And I was sitting, luckily, at the time next to one of my best friends who is a scholar of romantic disability. So she kind of held my hand and patted it whilst I had a bit of a sob quietly in the back of this conference paper. And I thought, is this how people will see my life, that I no longer exist if I can't write about myself or if I can't talk about myself? What kind of aspects of our lives does this kind of story favor? And I began to look into Dorothy Wordsworth's life. and start to delve into that. And I realized that she had been fascinatingly, really fascinatingly misdiagnosed by lots of different people throughout her life. So I'm just going to read you a little bit of the introduction to the book that I'm just finishing at the moment, like really literally at this moment. I was meant to hand it in last week, and I'm hoping to hand it in by the end of this week. So for those of you who don't know, Dorothy Wordsworth is as well known as the author of the Alfoxden and Grasmere Journals, which she wrote between 1798 and 1803. As she is as a sister of the poet William Wordsworth. She's praised for her physical vitality, as for her writing, for walking long distances, for stamina, strength, and a certain wildness. She's noted as a nature writer and as a woman who walked and climbed. Her worth as a writer has become tied to her physical capacity by book after book, which repeats these connections. Dorothy became increasingly unwell later in life. Despite her illness, which remains mysterious, she continued to write and keep journals until 1835. She lived another 20 years after that, dying on January 25th, 1855, at the age of 84, outliving her brother by 5 years. Dorothy Wordsworth's biographers have had a peculiar predilection for killing her long before her death. Ernest de Selincourt, in his 1933 biography, separates off the last 20 years of her life from 1835 to 1855 as posthumous life, life after death. He explains, "The 20 years of posthumous life that followed only belong to the biography of Dorothy Wordsworth insofar as they reveal in fitful gleams something of what she once had been." No one, he implies, should want or need to know about what he calls her days of insensibility or mental vagary. In a weighty biography, actually it's propping up my computer right now, that is otherwise thoughtful and thorough in its presentation of the records of her life, this elision is particularly striking. This 20 years of posthumous life is a tragedy it is better not to speak of, or if one absolutely must, give it 8 pages at most. Helen Derbyshire follows this line in her 1958 edition of Dorothy's journals, pointing to a prolonged period of life in death before Dorothy's actual death in 1855. In using the phrase life in death, Derbyshire summons up the ghastly spectre from Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner, with her red lips, free locks, gold hair, and skin as white as leprosy, who thicks man's blood with cold. This presents Dorothy as like the mariner, cursed, trapped in an in-between state, neither really living nor free to die. This reflects how many people think about disability and begins to explain the desire of biographers and scholars to choose a different ending for Dorothy, one they think is more fitting or more poetic. Frances Wilson, in her 2008 biography, The Ballad of Dorothy Wordsworth, which has been republished this year to mark 250 years since Dorothy's birth, takes it further, calling William's marriage to Mary in October 1803 Dorothy's funeral. She places what she calls the peak of Dorothy's life as a time between Christmas 1799 and October 1802. And describes her as fossilized for us in her Grasmere Journal, as though nothing happened to her either before or since. For a woman who lived to be 84, that seems a deliberate kind of denial of much of life. For Wilson, Dorothy becomes some kind of nightmare crone, literally the madwoman in the attic, with her long lost reason haunting the top of their house like the discarded first wife in Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. That's a quote from the actual biography. It seems convenient to her to condense Dorothy's later years into madness and a psychosomatic disorder, since to her, she died 50 years previously anyway. Carl Ketchum in 1978 is slightly more ambiguous, placing Dorothy not in death, but in darkness, mental darkness. This echoes Millicent Fawcett's description of Dorothy in her 1889 group biography, Some Eminent Women of Our Time. Her memory was darkened and her spirits, once so blithe and gay, became clouded and dull. For Ketchum, Dorothy's illness in 1829 marks not the end of her life, but the end of Dorothy's active life as a wanderer and sightseer. with her final journal entry in November 1835, "Darkness closes in." For him, this marks the end of Dorothy's long quest for beauty and experience. These later journals to him are a record of a relentless loss, which closes with the last fragmented entry. In her 1927 biography, Dorothy and William Wordsworth, Catherine MacDonald MacLean presents the final decades of Dorothy's life as too terrible to behold, writing, "We turn away from contemplation of these sad, inexplicable years." This is certainly the advice most biographers have taken. So this book arises from two tangled impulses, one more or less righteous or plausible than the other. Firstly, to shine a light into the darkness and restore the rest of Dorothy's narrative. William's marriage to Marina in 1803 was not Dorothy's funeral, literally or figuratively. She lived for another 52 years. But these are years we hear little about. This book hopes, if nothing else, to remind readers that Dorothy was still Dorothy all that time. She did not die, emotionally or otherwise, until 1855. She did not vanish. She was not undone. She may have changed, as we all do, in sickness and in health, but she was still Dorothy. The second is perhaps more dubious, a desire to understand her illness. We always read through the prism of our own biases. When some people look at the skeletal hand of Victorian poet Elizabeth Barrett Browning, they see a woman with an eating disorder. I see a woman with a physiological illness that was dismissed in her own lifetime and continues to be dismissed by generation after generation of scholars. I see hundreds of years of medical gaslighting. I see hints of a connective tissue disorder that could explain all the symptoms she records, including her dietary experiments and her miscarriages. This is my bias. So you already know, at 34, I was diagnosed with a hereditary connective tissue disorder. And then a year later, a hereditary iron loading disorder after decades of seeking diagnosis and being rebuffed. The myriad ways I have been told my symptoms were imaginary, stress-related, psychogenic, emotional, stemming from my oversensitivity could fill many books. So when I see readers, scholars, and biographers look at the lives of dead writers, writers they claim to admire, and disavow their testimony of their own bodies, I see what I have experienced myself. I cannot be certain that I am right and they are wrong. This is why I say that second driving force behind this book comes from a slightly dubious place. I believe it's both ethically and medically dubious to diagnose dead people from the partial record left from their writings and descriptions of them in other people's writings. It shouldn't be radical to say that, should it? But biographies of writers' lives are full of posthumous diagnoses of conditions we cannot be certain of. I know this. But I also know the compulsion to know what is wrong is strong. I know that we can't know. All we have, in the words of Dorothy from her poems, thoughts on my sickbed, are known and unknown things. So when I hear scholars describe her later years as non-time, as darkness or nothingness, I can't help wondering how they would describe portions of my own life. And that's what underpins this book, the idea that the lives of disabled people are as rich and worthwhile as the lives of non-disabled people. Even if you do not see us or hear us, we're still here. Her worth is not in her youthful vigor or lost in her illness, nor is she herself lost. This book hopes to let Dorothy's words live as well as her silences, and the silences imposed upon her by others, the cut pages of her journals removed by her great nephew. This book is my attempt to recover Dorothy.
Oh, Polly, what exciting work. Thank you so much. It's wonderful to hear.
Thank you.
Both of these projects, fantastic. So thank you so much for beautiful readings and sharing. We have some time for questions and responses and ideas. You're getting lots of glowing comments in the chat.
I can see Bonnie's asked, where is diagnosis published? It actually isn't yet. So it's kind of hanging around in limbo. I've had bits of the book published in various places, but not that chapter yet. And I'm hoping as soon as I finish this book, it's going to be my next priority to push again on getting that out. It's had a slightly strange history after the initial program that I was on. So it'll be out there one day.
We'll definitely have an audience.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you. It is such a necessary work, so important. I'm going to definitely get a copy. Thank you. Do you know if it can be, can I publish, can I purchase your book through a particular website or bookstore?
So the part that I read first, Diagnosis, isn't published yet. So it's
that one. Okay.
Yeah, it's not available at all. Okay. The Dorothy book is going to be published in November.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Okay.
Yeah, no, it's all right. It will be out soon.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I think I did read some of your essays on your website. If someone wanted to read more, they could start there.
Yeah.
More about your books.
Yeah, so there's, but very initially, the book project started as a few blogs that I wrote on my website about exactly these kind of issues. So there's kind of protozoic kind of forms of them there. And I've had some other pieces published that kind of discuss some of this. And I have a piece coming out in a small magazine in the UK called Sick about living with chronic illness. It's coming out shortly as well. So there's some similar work out there, but not that particular bit at the moment.
I have a question, Polly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you so much. Just gorgeous. It sucked me right in. It was just one, especially the first one. I love both, but that first one was just passionately helpful. I was wondering if you explore or kind of tie in, mental illness. I'm sure you don't, but I'm curious about diagnosis as, of course, in the medical world, very helpful. And then in the world of mental illness, correct diagnoses as identity as problematic. So I was curious if you could speak to that.
I'm really interested in that idea, and there's so much crossover, and so in the longer version of that chapter I deal more with some of the misdiagnoses that I've had over the years, which include anxiety and depression, and anorexia at one point, which if you saw me now is hard to imagine, but when I was a teenager for a while, when I was very sick, I kind of weighed 7 stone, and then various different versions of psychosomatic disorders as well, most latterly functional neurological disorder, and it's really hard to, so I have like my own personal feelings about some of these diagnoses, which are to do with them not being right for me, including diagnoses of ME and chronic fatigue syndrome and various things along the way as well. But I know for other people, those particular diagnoses are helpful as well and useful and also a large part of their identity. And I think sometimes particularly mental health diagnoses can feel similar to that, that there's a real kind of push and pull between people who find the whole diagnostic system alienating and destructive and violent and feel that it wants to destroy their life, essentially, and the kind of medical industrial complex around that, and other people who just desperately want to be able to put a name or a label on what is happening to them. And sometimes those two things actually meet in your own life in a peculiar way as well. So I kind of try to touch on that. I think that the way I've tried to handle it is by always thinking through the prism of my own experience and what I don't know about other people's experiences. So I think there's some really amazing and brilliant books which are written more journalistically about this kind of stuff, and from other people's different life experience positions as well. And every now and again, I kind of look back at bits of this and think, oh God, no, I can't write that. Just that has to go completely. but it is really fraught, and the whole idea of diagnosis is fraught as well. And you know, I'm sitting in a country where we do have a national health service, so I actually had to pay for my Ehlers-Danlos diagnosis. I had to pay to go private to see that one expert in the UK. My parents paid for me, and I'm in a very privileged position that I have parents who could pay for me and could also pay for my train fare to go down to London to see that guy, and a friend I could stay with. All of that made that diagnosis possible. And you know, in a different healthcare situation like you have in the States, that's an extra barrier to that as well. And diagnosis itself becomes an ever more distant kind of like Gatsby's green light receding on the dock. You know, what even could it be? And how much can you put into pursuing it? And I understand how a lot of people feel very conflicted about the whole idea of diagnosis. There's a really interesting memoir that came out this year in the UK by a woman called Josie George, who has very similar symptoms to me. It's called A Still Life, but doesn't have a diagnosis. And it's one of the few medical memoirs I've seen which are about what it is to live with without a name. And I think that's really interesting. But for me, obviously, being diagnosed with one thing then literally saved my life as well, because it unlocked the other, which had been ignored up until that point. I don't know if that really answers your question, but I hope it goes some way towards it.
Yes, that answers my question. And thank you for the informative answer. I do really appreciate it. Thanks, Polly. Lovely.
A couple of people just stuck their head up.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, Kuto.
Hi, David.
Yeah, hi, I'm David. I wanted to, thank you so much. I wanted to share two kind of anecdotes with you and get your feedback. Some of the, you've said, like you just mentioned diagnosis as violent, medical industrial complex. And some of the things you just said in response triggered so many things I want to sort of ask you about. But I'm going to focus on two anecdotes that I want to share with you. One is diagnosis, if you will, like neurological diagnosis or behavioral, whatever. So there was this story about this little girl in class who would always move. She'd always tap and move her legs, and they thought she had a learning disability. You could argue she does. But anyways, somebody came in one day and said, no. This girl is a dancer. That's why she needs to move. And she eventually graduated from Juilliard, you know, and became a professional dancer. So it's this concept of labeling things and not allowing for, you know, neurodiversity or behavioral skill sets, trying to force everybody down this, you know, educational path that they might not belong in. So that's the first piece. The second one I wanted to mention and see what you think is, I heard this on NPR. It's talking about how the medical industry has this culture of not admitting mistakes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a kind of dishonesty where they don't want to say, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how to handle this. And they have to be dogmatic and say, this is what it is. And like forcing misinformation to hide their lack of ability and knowledge in one particular area.
Yeah, I think the second of those particularly has become really interesting this last year, hasn't it? And in the rest of the introduction, the end of the introduction to the Dorothy book, I draw a comparison between her experiences and even how long COVID is being treated now, because I think it's very easy for us as readers now to look back at romantic medicine and say, you know, all the leeches and mustard blisters and things and think, oh God, what were these people doing? It's so barbaric. You know, in 100 years time, they'll look back at what we're doing the same way. And that problem that is raised about not being able to say, I don't know, has become so important, I think, this last year or so. And it's become part of everybody's lives instead of just the lives of people who are dealing with a condition in some way. Because I think if you are dealing with a condition, you've definitely come across that impossibility of of saying, no, actually, I don't know what this is. And one of the things in the longer version of that chapter I do call for is doctors to please learn how to say, I don't know what this is, instead of, I don't know what it is, therefore there isn't anything there, which is a big difference. Right? There's a massive difference between those two things. So yeah, very much agree with that. Yeah, Nicole.
You know, I was curious too. First of all, your writing was so beautiful, and I was just thinking how you, how amazing it is. Thank you for even just doing that work so that you could share that, because part of it was learning to have more sensitivity and compassion so that we all have a broader perspective. And then my other question was, as you were talking, it made me think about environmentally, how, mm-hmm. how many of the things that we're ingesting are in some ways bringing up these diagnoses that we may not have had existed even 100 years ago, but just because of pollution and plastic. And I just kind of wondered if you, what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, so there's a really amazing, so some of my academic work is in kind of eco-criticism and that kind of area, or it kind of touches on that. And there's a really amazing anthology of writing about the kind of intersection of disability studies and environmental studies that came out a couple of years ago. I'm trying to think of the title. It's got eco-crip in the title and the rest of it's just gone from my mind, but it's a really great anthology and the first that kind of puts those two things together. And there's a really interesting point in that where one of the authors kind of argues kind of a different version of what you just said, that often people with chronic illnesses and disabilities are more sensitive to environmental changes as well. So kind of positioning us as kind of canaries in the mine really, that things like not being able to cope with scented environments. And I have a lot of problems with skin sensitivity and chemical sensitivity, as a lot of chronically ill people do. And so I'm hyper aware about some of those pollutants in our environment because I feel them very viscerally. So I've been aware of those for a lot longer than most people I know have in their lives. And I think environmental studies could do a lot from listening to disabled people about those experiences. On the wider kind of idea of as someone who's also like partly a literary historian, I suppose, I always have a slight query about, are things worse now than they were 200 years ago, 300 years ago, or are they just different? Do we suffer from different kinds of pollution? I know with the Wordsworths, one of the things that they were continually complaining about was cold and damp and mold in their houses because they didn't have central heating and smoky chimneys and having to have coal fires all the time. So there's part of those things that I think are contemporary problems. And part of me thinks, somebody asked a really interesting question on Twitter the other day about water pollution and what time, then thinking what time period would you go to get a clean river? And I thought, I don't know, because before sewers, they were full of everything. when is clean? When are we not polluted? I think you'd have to go back quite a long time.
Polly, thank you so much. We're almost out of time, but there is an active conversation going on in the chat. Allison, you have a question here about the medical versus the social model.
Yeah. So hi, Polly. Thank you for your work. So I live with a disability too. I live with cerebral palsy and I use a walker and wheelchair and all sorts of stuff to navigate my environment. And when I had grown up with, you know, disability and feeling a certain way about it and not having the language to sort of express what I knew intuitively what was happening for me and I was feeling and going through. And then when I got to graduate school, my first graduate school experience, I was introduced to the idea of the social model, which says the barriers are disabling versus the person is the problem and the person has to be cured. And that opened a whole new world of like amazingness for me and changed my whole perspective about myself and my own identity. So I would love to hear from you. What's your perspective on the social medical model, and how have you dealt with it, and in what ways has it come up for you in your life and your diagnosis?
So similarly to you, I've had a real kind of journey with how I've thought about that, and for me, a lot of that was about actually in a kind of medical model way, getting my diagnosis and realizing actually that all my problems were genetic, so they were just part of me. They were in me at the smallest part of me, and they're incurable. They are me. I wouldn't be me if I didn't have my impairments. And that really changed. I said it changed. It didn't really change the way I was thinking about it, because it unlocked something I was already thinking. And there's a large part of the memoir book as well, which is a kind of anti-nature cure rant, essentially. Because a lot of nature writing in the UK particularly, and I think a bit in the States, not quite so much, does kind of have this nature cure element that, you know, if you have anything wrong with you, just go lick a tree. Yeah. Go outside, lick a tree. I mean, in the UK, it's turned into actual green prescribing now. So doctors can prescribe you time outside, and that's meant to cure you. I mean, I live amongst lakes and mountains. I go wild swimming. Guess what? I'm still disabled because I'm disabled. That's not going to make it go away. It makes it makes my quality of life slightly better. But that's kind of by the by. And if I don't have medication, I can't go outside. So there's a really important link between those things. I know a lot of chronically ill people struggle with the social model because they kind of argue that no amount of accommodation would make their impairment not absolutely debilitating. Mm-hmm. But I, in some ways, I think sometimes when people think that, they're not thinking far enough about adaptation. So I realized when I decided not to reapply for a full-time job after I left that horrible academic role that made me cry all the time that I talked about, I decided I wouldn't do that to myself again. And I realized that actually a lot of the problems for me are expectations about productivity, about being up in the morning.
Yes.
You know, so much of the way our lives are structured, which people don't think about when they're thinking about adaptation. You know, they think about ramps. Yeah. They don't think about the whole capitalist productive system in which we live. And for me, that's the disabling environment, actually.
That's definitely part of it. And I'm going to say something a little bit taboo here, is that like, I've been struggling with this feeling ever since the pandemic started of like, feeling things are more accessible to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm living a bit of a better life because of the, than I was. Not that my life was bad prior to the pandemic, but I'm living a much better life and being able to show up more authentically in this space because I'm not worried about the structures of capitalism. Like, oh, I have to dress a certain way. I have to talk a certain way. I have to look a certain way. I have to be on time, and I have to leave my apartment a half hour early because I walk so slow. So my life in some ways has gotten better. And that can be taboo because there's so many different people around that are saying, oh, like the pandemic has taken so much away from us. And yes, in one way, but think about it from another perspective that's not your own.
I think it's really interesting in terms of disability as well, because I'm not sure about the stats in the States, but as of November 2020, 66% of people in the UK who died from COVID were disabled. So it's massively more hit disabled people.
Yes.
But on the other hand, it has just opened up access in this extraordinary way. And exactly what you've said, I've heard so many friends say again and again, and I feel that myself as well, that it's made accessibility of certain things mainstream in a way that it never would have been without the pandemic, because able-bodied people need it too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Polly, thank you so much for this lively discussion. We're a bit over time, so we should wrap up. But obviously, we have so much to talk about and so many wonderful ideas and perspectives. Thank you, everyone, for being so active and attending and these great questions and discussion. And Polly Adkin, thank you so much for leading us and for this wonderful work, which we'll look forward to reading when it comes out this fall, and your other project, which I'm sure will be out in print soon. We'll be cheering for you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.